Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
He took me up to his little makeshift kind of museum that he had of his personal artifacts. And he had a picture of him, Fidel Castro, and Ernest Hemingway standing together, ball with their rods in their hands. It was a marlin tournament that they went over for. And Ernest and Fidel were fishing together and apparently invited Lefty to join them. And it was a really cool little story.
That was James Thule with another amazing Lefty Cray story. The Trout and Salmonid Library, Bud Lilly, Bozeman, and Lefty today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the show. We're wrapping up the big giveaway to the Skeena Spey Lodge this summer, and we're announcing the winner tonight live on Facebook. If you want to check it out, wetflyswing.com/live, and you can find out who won if you entered, or if you jump on live, we always give away some bonus products as well for people that are on there. So check it out, wetflyswing.com/live. Today's episode is sponsored by Maverick Fly Fishing. They make the lightest Euro-nymphing reel in the world, which makes your rod more sensitive, casting more accurate, and you can hold your dead drifts longer without shoulder burn. Check out Maverick Fly Fishing Stinger and their other Euro-nymph products and support this podcast by heading over to wetflyswing.com/maverick right now. That's Maverick, M-A-V-R-K, wetflyswing.com/maverick. Check out the lightest and most unique Euro-nymphing reel right now. Today's episode is sponsored by Tressel, who you know from their game-changing telescopic fly rod roof rack systems. But did you also know that Tressel just released the only universal bike rack system designed exclusively for the angler and outdoorsman? You can check out this new universal rack system at wetflyswing.com/tressel right now to see their full line of gear-carrying products and the Artist Series apparel. That's Tressel, T-R-X-S-T-L-E. Tressel, live your pursuit. James Thule is here from Montana State University to share his angling stories and one of the most interesting and one-of-a-kind trout libraries in the country. We find out and discover how this massive trout and salmonid library got started, who James has interviewed over the years, some pretty amazing, famous people, and what the future of the potential podcasting and the podcast might look for the Angling History Museum here. We're going to check it out. Plus, we hear the story of how James built his off-the-grid home from scratch in Montana. Here we go, James Thule from the MSU Angling Oral History Project. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on here. We've been, I think, probably a lot of people that don't know about what you have going. You essentially have an archive of fishing, and I mean, it's not only fishing, it's... how would you explain what you have going, the Angling Oral History Project and everything at MSU?
Sure. So our project actually started with our trout and salmonid collection. So we have the world's largest collection of books on trout and salmon. That was started with one of our former deans, Bruce Morton, and Bud Lilly. They were the ones that planted the seed for that idea. We're such a fishing destination. We have so many anglers and authors in our area that we thought it would be a good thing. So right now we have the largest collection of books on trout and salmonids, including a book signed by Isaac Walton. We have the first book to ever mention Fishing in the New World, approaching 20,000 volumes overall now. And then these other projects kind of sprouted from there. So we have a digital trout art collection. We have our archives. We have the largest collection of archival material on anglers. So we have like the papers of Dave Hughes, Bud Lilly, Nick Lyons, John Garrock, Ed Engel, et cetera. The list, A.K. Best, the list goes on. Several years ago, probably a decade or more ago, a little bit, Bud was telling me a story about this, about a guy that he had taken fishing in the, I believe it was in the 80s. And I'm going to paraphrase it a little bit. I believe it was on the Madison. It was an older gentleman, and the fish were rising. It was perfect for fishing. The guy really couldn't walk that well anymore, couldn't get around that well, but he could still cast, couldn't really see that good. And Bud directed him to cast into some rising browns, and he landed one. And as Bud was releasing the fish, he turned around and the guy was taking apart his rod. And Bud's like, you know, the fish are still rising, we can catch more fish. And he said, no, that's as fine as fish as I've ever caught, and it's the last one I'm ever going to catch.
Oh,
and
wow.
He died just a couple weeks later. But wow. It really struck me that, it, for myself too, fishing has been important to me my whole life, and it's something that's kind of in my blood, and it obviously was with this gentleman as well. And it occurred to me that we should be recording these type of stories and preserving them for future anglers and learning about the culture of angling as well. So that's how the Oral History Project got started.
Wow, that's really good. And what year was that when it got started?
It was about 12 years ago.
Oh, 12 years ago. Wow. So 12 years, and it's 23 now. So that was essentially 2011.
Right around there.
Yeah, right around there. Do you remember when you started? Do you remember were there, I know there were podcasts around. Were you thinking like this oral history was, you know, kind of, did you think about the podcasting as you were doing it, or how'd that look?
I mean, podcasts were something that we explored. One of the things that I really wanted to do is Paul Schilleri and I really worked on this, on developing this. And one of the things I really wanted to do was video record the interviews. And part of the reason for that was, as humans, we convey so much information through our body language. And I really wanted to be able to show somebody's face when they tell these stories. And so that was why we went with the video. But it's been a great run.
That's right. And now, and I know we'll put a link out at wetflyswing.com/MSU for Montana State University. Well, that'll redirect them over to the Angling Oral History Project.
Correct.
Which shows, you know, everything you have doing. And there's a search thing there, right? So you could search for anybody.
Absolutely.
So when people click that, they open up basically it has a video. So everything's, you can watch it on the website, right? That's pretty
Correct.
Much how it works.
Yep.
Okay. And so there's not necessarily like a YouTube channel to go to. It's all right on the website.
Correct. It is all right on the website. Yep. We've got, we're just uploading a bunch more videos in total. We've done around 370 interviews with anglers from around 65, 70 countries on, 6 continents. And part of the thing that we're doing right now is making them all AODA accessible. So we're adding transcripts to all the interviews.
There you go. And I see, yeah, you have a long list. And remind me again, how many total interviews have you done?
Around 360, 370 total interviews.
Yeah, 360. And then you're doing those, how often are they popping out there on the website?
So we kind of will go in waves. I'll go on a trip and I'll do 20 interviews on a trip or something like that. So they come in spurts.
They come in spurts. Does it seem like after doing 360 of these that you find it's hard to find new people? Because I'd imagine you're trying to find the best of the best. Is that true, or do you have a mix?
So it is absolutely a mix. We certainly do want to focus on, we do get the Bud Lillies and the John Garricks and the Nick Lyons and things like that. But I'm real interested in also hearing from the average anglers. So that's, I have done interviews on the sides of rivers in Sierra Leone and India and all over the world with subsistence anglers, people who have spent their entire life fishing the rivers for a living, Peru, just all over the world. And I think their stories are as important to document, if not more important than other folks, just because there's not a lot of people out there collecting that information and documenting their experience with angling. And the global culture, I think, needs that larger representation of kind of the rock stars and, you know, the average Joes like me.
And do you have some people on there that you're thinking like, hey, these are people we would love to have on, but maybe they just not, you know, maybe they're just kind of the big superstar just haven't been on yet. Are there any on that list, that bucket list?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly some folks on there that Paul and I have never done an interview. I'd really like to get to catch Paul one of these days. Skip Morris is somebody I'd like to interview. There's quite a few folks that I'm absolutely still interested in interviewing. Yeah. And I'd like some more representation. One of the things that we've really worked to do is to make sure it's not just a bunch of old white guys like me that are telling their stories. So we'd like to make sure that we have women represented, you know, folks of all races and backgrounds represented in this, because fishing really is a global culture, and all our voices should be heard in kind of recording that history.
That's right. That is a challenge too, isn't it? With women, do you find that, do you have any idea out of those 360, how many are women?
I don't have a solid number off the top of my head, but I would probably throw in 10-15%. We've done our best to kind of seek out women, and certainly when I travel, I've always done that, and we've had some great interviews on the road. I interviewed. It was in Cambodia. I interviewed a woman who runs a small fly shop there. But part of the stories that she told too about were about her parents living through the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot. So it's always interesting to get these kind of background history stories about that connect angling to kind of life and the things we go through. People I interviewed in Germany talked about having to sneak hooks and rods and things like that. You know, when the Berlin Wall was still in effect. So,
right, right. Yeah. And we're similar just as far as women. I mean, I think we have about the same 10% or so, right, of women in our, just in our listenership. And probably it's about the same. I think we have a similar number of interviews on our show. So yeah, it's not easy. It's something I think about a lot, but it just seems like, right, it's, even though you talk here about the 50-50 and all that stuff, it seems like it's still a challenge, right? Trying to get equal numbers of all this.
It absolutely is. Yeah. And I don't know that we'll ever necessarily get equal numbers, but we definitely want representation. We want as many and as diverse of voices like yourself in the podcast here, you know, represented, to really kind of represent for you or your full audience, and for us to represent the kind of full cultural history.
And do you get people that kind of reach out to you and just say, hey, I'd love to be on your show. This is what I do. Do you get that occasionally?
Occasionally, absolutely, yeah. I do get people that I'll meet. I'll go to conclaves or to conferences and things like that, and they'll, you know, have a story to tell, or they'll say, "You should really talk to my mother, or my father, or my brother, or I've got a friend who has a, you know, has been running a fly shop for the last 30 years. You should really speak with him about it." And so that's great. I mean, one of the ways that this really has grown is through that word of mouth, people connection, you know, people telling me about other people that have stories to share.
Yep, exactly. Nice. Well, let's maybe broaden it out a little bit to the bigger picture, and maybe just take us back to Montana State University and talk about maybe first where that is for those that don't know, because we have listeners kind of all around the country. Where is Montana State? And then talk about what this oral history, the kind of what you do on a daily, weekly basis.
Sure, absolutely. So Montana State University is located in beautiful Bozeman, Montana. So some of the best trout country in the world, I would argue. We've got some great blue ribbon streams, some more close to, not far from Yellowstone Park, not that far from Glacier, and just have some incredible fishing opportunities for trout and salmonids, including our native cuts and native trout. So that was, as I mentioned earlier, that was really the kind of the impetus for starting this collection there, was that we were kind of in the middle of, you know, dreamland for trout fishing country. So we thought it was a good mix idea that somebody could come in and read about a place that they've wanted to fish and then actually go out and dip their toes in the water. One of the collections that we just have received from a pretty prominent author, that was one of the things that we talked about when he decided to give us his archival material, was the idea that you can really connect place with the writings by being right there in Montana on a daily basis. So I'm the special collections librarian at MSU. Most of the work that I do is directly involved with our Trout and Salmonid collection. So doing interviews is certainly part of my job, and then collecting materials. So as I mentioned, we have the, you know, we have a pretty large book collection on angling, and that is, my old Dean Bruce used to call it the 6 degrees of trout and salmon. So we collect anything that relates back to those species. So we're not a fly fishing collection, but we have a wealth of material on fly fishing and fly tying, building rods, all that kind of good stuff. But we'll have things on salmon sharks. We'll have things on dam removal. We have poetry. We have literature. We have anything that will connect back to those species. Our goal is to be the most comprehensive research center in the world for anything related to trout and salmonids. So anything that connects back, we will collect and preserve that material on. Game laws. Game laws are a really interesting thing. We have game laws going back to the 1700s. And it's, from a research perspective, I always think they're really cool. I mean, you can track invasive species through them. So, and I know people don't like to think of rainbow brookies and browns as invasive, but in a lot of places they are, right? But the idea of being able to track when was the brook trout population in Montana large enough and healthy enough to be regulated, or the browns. And you can do that through game laws. And that's pretty interesting. You can really track the health of a body of water through bag limits. And it's one of the cool little kind of mini collections, I guess, in the larger collection that I really like. And just kind of getting those odd government documents on canning salmon in the 40s or something like that. We had one from Alaska that's just on that. And I always thought it was interesting because people are dying from improperly canned fish. And we have this material that shows them how to properly can it. So I do a lot of work with that, a lot of work with toners, a lot of work with seeing what new material is out there, kind of hunting for older books, things to fill in our collections. One of the things that's always really tough is with periodicals. So I think we have around 500 or so different periodical titles, so magazines, journals, and things like that. But people hang on to books. You know, you read a book, you put it back on your shelf, you have it there for forever and a day. You might pass that on to your children. Magazines, we tend to use, you know, you leave in the bathroom, you leave in your car, when you're done with it, you kind of toss it out. And so many publishers have changed hands so many times now that filling in gaps on periodicals is one of the more difficult things that I try to do. But what we're looking for is to have a complete run of every periodical that we have. And nothing's more frustrating for a researcher to, oh, I know this article was published in this, you know, the June 1976 issue, and they come in and we have everything but the June 1976 issue. So
right, that's cool. Yeah, so you guys have, I mean, essentially, and this is everywhere. This is not just the U.S. This is kind of worldwide. Anything trout or salmonids.
That is absolutely true. We collect on a global nature, so we have materials that are French, Russian, German, Latin, you name it. We get periodicals from Italy, from Poland, from France, all over the world. We'll collect that information and document it and keep it.
Gotcha. And would people be able to, like, if somebody was listening here, could they, how would they track, would they be able to read some of this or look online, or how does that look? Or could you go in person?
Of course. Yeah. So we are a land grant institution. So anybody can come in through our doors and use any of the material that we have available. We will, through your local library, you can request an interlibrary loan, and we will digitize any material you'd like us to digitize and send you a digital copy of that. Several of our archival collections, Datus Proper, Bud Lilies, Nick Lyons. We have several that are digitized or we're working on digitizing, and that is an ongoing process. We hope to eventually digitize all of our archival collections just to be able to make them available to anyone, anywhere, at any time. But for our printed material, yeah, it's, you can always come in and kind of browse the stacks and check things out. And I certainly encourage you, if you are coming out to Bozeman or the general area, to get a line in the water for some bull trout or some cuts or some rainbows or browns, to let me know, to reach out, and I will be happy to provide you with a tour of our collections. I will let you hold in your hands a book that was signed by Isaac Walton. So you can hold in your hand something that Isaac Walton held in his.
That's pretty amazing. So is that one of the items that it's, and that's the one you just got, right? Is that one of those ones that's just, it's kind of at top of the list of things you have there?
That is, yeah, we had a donor several years ago who I gave a tour to, a really nice gentleman, and he had collected some pretty rare books, and as he was kind of getting up in years, he gave me a call and he said, I'm sending you some things, they belong there, and this was one of the items he sent us. That's one of our cooler items, one of the things I always like to pull out. We've got some really cool old animal encyclopedias that were done in the late 1500s, early 1600s, and I love showing those to people. They'll have pictures of griffins and unicorns and things like that, alongside with, you know, hippos and other creatures. And then the fish diagrams, especially the old woodblock cuts, are, and the engravings are so incredibly detailed. The hours that people spent to document what these creatures of the deep look like from both a external and internal perspective is really, really interesting. But we've got some great gems. We've got some really, really cool things. We've got books signed by presidents and authors and lots of famous folks. So you always have that intrinsic value of it belonging to somebody famous or being present somewhere. And then the informational value. And of course, what we as a research library are always focused on is the informational value. We want to provide that first and foremost. Well, we have a lot of rare books. As I mentioned, we have a copy of the first book to ever mention fishing in the New World. I think that was published in 1521. And that's a pretty cool item. It's a letter documenting fish in Rome, but I think it was written by a bishop, and just in passing, they mentioned the reports coming back from the New World of the abundance of fish. But it's a pretty cool item to be able to, and I just think it's neat to be able to hold in your hand something that's been sitting on somebody's bookshelf for 500 years.
Right.
But, so there's probably no real substitute for that, you know, visceral in-person experience of being able to smell that paper and see those books. But if you want copies of anything that we have, you can always reach out to me directly, and I'll be happy to help. And then again, your local library should offer interlibrary loan. You can make a request, and we will go ahead and digitize that and send it right off to you.
There you go. So you can do that. So literally, if somebody found something, that's always a question too, like you said, with periodicals or anything, you know, you want to get something, it's not there. So they could just go in, either call you or search. And if they find it, you could send them it digitally for free.
Absolutely.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Okay. So this is even better than I was thinking. This is a full, yeah. I mean, obviously it's a library, and I was just looking at one link. I'm looking at your alphabetical list of like topics, and the American Museum of Fly Fishing is one of them. So it looks like you've had some interviews. That's one of those things, because there's other, you know, resources out there. Do you find that there's other similar universities that are doing something like what you guys are doing? Maybe not quite as big, but similar?
So there are absolutely other places out there that have amazing fishing collections or fly fishing collections. There's no other library that I'm aware of that focuses on the species like we do. But we do work really well with other institutions. So we just finished a project with the American Museum of Fly Fishing, where they had a bunch of interviews that had been conducted quite some time ago. And a lot of them were on audio cassette. And they were sitting in their archives. But I'm certainly old enough to remember having a cassette player in my car and recording songs off the radio and things like that when I was younger. But people don't have that anymore. So that's one of the things with an archive is not only do you have to keep that material, so old floppy disks and things like that, but you have to keep the material, the machines that will allow you to access that information. And audio cassettes and things like that, they weren't built to last. They're under constant stress, 8-track, anything with a tape. So it is, it will fail eventually. So what we did anyway with the project with them was we made an agreement, and it worked out great for everybody. They sent us these rare, unique interviews, these kind of one-of-a-kind things. And we took them, and we worked with our student workers and myself and some other professionals who oversaw the project, and we digitized everything. So we sent them back both the originals and then digital versions of them, and then we included the digital versions in our project. And so we were able to access information. Some of the folks there were no longer around, so we were able to get those interviews included in our larger project. And for them, we were able to help take information that was somewhat inaccessible and make it much more accessible. So it was a win-win. We've had great relationships with certainly with FFI and TU and other organizations as well. So,
yep. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I'm looking now. You got TU, Esther, Lily. I guess that's, but Lily's wife, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Yep.
And Alan Baker. A whole bunch, like you said, 360 interviews, right? These are all interviews you have out there.
Yeah, we've got a wealth of them, that's for sure.
Quick break for a word from our sponsor. With more than 40 years of experience in coffee, the Angler's Coffee Team roasts a full range of coffee with one goal in mind, delivering excellent coffee to every single angler. Responsibly sourced from farms using sustainable growing practices, you can rest easy knowing you are doing your part. Roasted and shipped within 48 hours to assure freshness. For me, it's all about that freshness and taste. When I crack open a bag of Anglers in the morning, I feel good because I know not only does it taste great, but I am supporting great movements along the way. With a blend for every taste, a dry dropper on the go teabag option, and a roast sampler, you know Joe at Anglers is serving your needs. It's time to step up to better coffee and more impact for the fish species and causes we love. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/anglers right now to grab a bag of greatness today. That's Anglers, A-N-G-L-E-R-S, to make a change today. Well, maybe you could take us in for somebody who hasn't, and we'll have a link, like I said, out there so people can listen to some of these, but maybe give us a heads up. And I know this is always a tough question because I get this sometimes as well. Like, what are the most memorable or the biggest interviews you've done? I see you have some big ones on here. Is there anything that sticks out if you had to say, hey, go listen to this one because it was really, really cool?
Certainly Bud Lilly's interviews are always great. Bud was a good friend and a character, and had some incredible stories to tell. So Bud Lilly's interviews that we've done too with Bud were always fun. A few other folks that were all the interviews are great, but a few other folks that really jump out at me. AK Best in his interview told a story about what fishing means to him. And it's an incredible story. I won't ruin it, but he really sets the stage well. AK is a great guy and just a real, real genuine person. Pierre Effry, when I was in Paris, I interviewed him at his apartment right by Pont Neuve. Just like a block down the road from it. And he told stories about fishing in the 50s in Africa and across France. And a guy who had an encyclopedic knowledge of fisheries in and around Europe and told stories about how, you know, salmon used to run up the Seine, right? You could catch salmon right from the bridges in Paris, and about how those are coming back now with the European Common Union's rules on clean water, and how important that is, that even in some of the worst polluted rivers over time are coming back, and that's great.
So when you go into these interviews, let's say maybe it's somebody you don't know that well, how do you approach it? What's your preparation look like when you get ready for doing one of these?
So I always try to do a little research. I always try to get a little information on who I'm interviewing. We try to ask, or I try to ask, a standard set of questions. And part of that is so that we have that data for researchers across a wide swath. So I always ask people about whether they've seen changes in angling, whether, you know, for better or worse, how they got started angling, what it means to them. So kind of these kind of baseline questions that I ask of everybody. And then like Nat Reed. So Nat Reed was was a politician and an incredible environmentalist. But I know he worked for Nixon. I know he worked for Ford, and it really led an incredible life. But asking Nat questions about what it was like to, you know, work in that environment. And that helped us get the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. I mean, it really did some incredible things. And so I'll ask questions around somebody's area of expertise, like Nick Lyons. I would ask about, you know, the publishing world and things like that. And then I will let the story kind of go where it goes. You know, one of the things that I really like is making sure that I know enough about the area of that person's expertise, about the environment, about the nation, if I'm overseas or what have you, to be able to ask the right follow-up questions. The example I always give is if I'm interviewing somebody about angling and they tell me, well, that was back in the time when I was hanging out a lot with Fidel Castro. I follow up on that, right? So, and I did when I did an interview several years back, and God, and now the for some reason the name is just escaping me.
I was just gonna say, does that happen to you? This happens to me because, like I said, it's at 200. When I was below 200 episodes, it felt like I could remember the number, episode number, the person. But now that I'm over it, it seems like I forget. Is that the case for you too?
Yeah, absolutely. They will kind of I don't want to say necessarily blend for me, but yeah, I'll be able to kind of recall those little bits and pieces. And I'm sure this is going to come to me in a minute and I'll be reminded of it. I absolutely will, things will come together. It can be hard to kind of to piece them out sometimes as you get more under your belt, I guess. But
you had somebody that was that knew Fidel or connected with Fidel.
Yeah, and God, I should know his name off the top of my head, and I just don't, and it's going to bug me, and it'll pop out to me. But anyway, he showed me a picture of Lefty Cray. I don't know why I couldn't grasp that, but I guess I turned 51 this year, so
maybe
my memory's starting to slip a little. But
yeah, so you had that's one of the people I didn't have a chance to have on. What was the Lefty Cray like?
Lefty was just a cool guy incredibly smart. I mean, just one of the quickest wits of anybody I've ever met. He had he had great jokes. He had great stories to tell. But after our interview, he took me up to, I interviewed him at his house, and he took me up to his little makeshift kind of museum that he had of his personal artifacts. And he had a picture of him, Fidel Castro, and Ernest Hemingway standing together, ball with their rods in their hands. And,
wow, that's, geez.
There yeah, you go. That's...
what was the story behind that? Did he tell the story?
Yeah. I guess they had gone... it was a Marlin tournament that they went over for. And Ernest and Fidel were fishing together and apparently invited Lefty to join them. And... It was a really cool little story, but I mean, the photograph, that's just...
Yeah. Do you have that photograph? Is that somewhere out there?
That is out there. That's not part of our collections, but that was Lefty, but it has been preserved.
Oh, it has. So I wonder, I wonder where you could track that one down. Would that be in the American Museum maybe?
I believe it is at the American Museum of Fly Fishing. I could certainly double check, but I think that's where Lefty had left his material. But
yeah, I wouldn't mind getting a... link to that in the show notes just so somebody could see what that looks like.
If I had that photo, it would be on my business card. I mean, it would just, if that I did, and again, I'm gonna fail to remember the gentleman's name, but I interviewed a guy in London And again, a really nice guy. He'd written a couple things on fly fishing. And boy, I'm losing tracks of names today for some reason. But anyway, he had met Eric Clapton in a fly fishing shop and got Eric to sign his book saying something like, "You're my hero." And he took that and had it put on the back of his business card. And,
perfect.
So that was a pretty cool thing.
Oh man, that is cool. That was, yeah, it's hard, you know, again, yeah, it's just Lefty, right? You hear, yeah. I've heard a lot of stories about him from people that knew him, and it's always the same thing. You know, it seems like the fishing is what, you know, connected him, but it's never, you always hear it's like the person, right? That's always the story, yeah. You hear about how, what he was as a person, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, Tom McGuane told me a story about going out with him not long before he passed, and, you know, he couldn't move around that well anymore, but he could still, you know, he could still cast with the best of them.
Yeah, he could. That's the thing, the casting, right? That's one of the cool things with fly fishing is that, you know, all these other sports, or a lot of these other sports, you know, snowboarding, whatever it is, you're not doing that until you're 90. But fly fishing, you know, you can in a lot of cases, right?
Yeah.
Because the casting, you never lose it.
No, that is, well, some of us never get it, but yeah, I'm still trying, but.
That's true. Well, take us back there. Let's go back on that because we kind of missed that at the start. What was your, you know, how did you first get into fly fishing? Was this like early age or when did that start?
No. So I didn't start fly fishing until I moved to Montana. I've been growing up spinning and bait fishing. I grew up in Wisconsin. My first memories of fishing was my mother took me to a fishing tournament on Stevenson Island, the border river, the Menominee River between the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Wisconsin. And I still distinctly remember thinking I had a snag, and I caught, I don't know, maybe an 18-inch, 20-inch. It was what we called a dogfish at the time. I think it might have been a carp species. I'm not really sure. But I still remember that. I still remember that kind of magic of realizing there was life on the end of my line. And that was, I think, the mystery of it is what drew me to fishing, never knowing what's tugging on the end of there. And that's what I've stuck with. But when I moved out to Montana, I was still spinning. I was interested in fly fishing and I'd bought a fly rod. A good friend of mine, Jason Clark, had told me to set up a hula hoop in my yard and cast to that. And so I tried that, but didn't have a lot of luck. And I was telling Bud about this and he said, "Let's go out." And so he took me out a little place on the, we weren't on the, we were on the Gallatin. He took me out and gave me some tricks to casting and gave me some really good tips on how to read the water, where the fish were going to be. And sure enough, every time I was able to land a cast where Bud wanted me to put it, a fish would rise.
That's pretty cool. What was the, do you remember the one of those tips that he gave you about fishing?
One of my favorite tips that he gave me about fishing was he said, "Jim, the, well, I'll give you two of them, but one of them was, Jim, the fish don't know whether you're using a $900 rod or a $90 rod. It's, you know, it's sometimes as anglers, we can certainly tell the difference. And don't get me wrong, I'd love to be able to afford a $900 or $9,000 rod, but it's not in my budget right now. And the other advice he gave me was he said, for the most part, fish strike for two reasons. They're hungry or they're pissed.
There you go. And Bud now, is he alive still?
No, Bud passed several years back. Esther just passed, I believe, 2 years ago now, a year and a half ago. Bud was a good friend. I was actually at a conference in Sri Lanka when Bud died, but I was so happy. I was able to work it out. I actually got a taxi driver who had a tuk-tuk driver who had an international card because my cell phone wouldn't work over there. And I was able to pay him to be able to use his phone. So I was able to call back, call the hospital, and speak with Esther and be able to say goodbye to Bud. And I was always really grateful that I was able to do that because he was a really important guy in my life. And so was Esther. I stayed up with Esther until she passed. I still stay in touch with Chris, their youngest son. And we're just good people.
Right. Yeah. That's, and Bud is obviously a huge name out in that area. He we know the guys at Big Sky, right? They think they purchased Bud, where Bud's shop used to be.
Sure.
There. And so, yeah, it's a history, right? I mean, these Bud created something there that's living on right past him, which is something I think a lot of us probably wish that we could do. Do you feel like, you know, like when you look at what you have going with this oral, you know, everything you have going here, is that, I mean, what keeps you going here? What is that the thing for you? You're thinking like, wow, I'm really documenting these connections with these people that some people would never know about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like if I've done anything in my career or my life that will kind of have a legacy and leave something behind me, it's the work I've done with the Trout and Salmonid Collection. It's the work that creating this oral history project and being able to apply for grants to be able to fund it, especially for the travel, to be able to do these interviews in places where I truly believe a lot of this information would not have been documented. You know, just in Mauritius and Sierra Leone and kind of really places off the beaten track. But I think leaving that behind and leaving this wealth of information, not only on angling, but kind of on the connections of angling, why we fish health, climate change. I mean, just kind of documenting this on really a global scale. Plus, what's been really cool about it is that I've been able to travel quite a bit. So I've been able to fish some really cool spots. I've had some really interesting adventures angling and been able to actually catch fish on six continents now.
So. Oh, wow. Well, what's one of those spots that's kind of you wouldn't think that's maybe kind of remote and that you fished and that's memorable?
So there's certainly a few rivers. I'd fished part of the White Nile in Uganda. And it was incredible, but I mean, it was really good fishing for Nile perch there. I also fished Lake Victoria there and did catch an oil perch there. But I've had some good luck, but a lot of it so much, like I think for all of us, and one of the things that really comes across in the angling oral histories is fishing is part of it, right? But it's also about being there. It's also about, you know, seeing the birds in the sky, you know, smelling the flowers, just the general experience of being in nature is so important. And I think that's as much of a draw for fishing as anything, especially with those of us who primarily do catch and release, right? It's no longer about harvesting that meal. It's not about taking that fish home. It's about being out there. My brain is slipping on the name, but one of my favorite quotes is maybe fishing for me was just an excuse to be near rivers. And if so, I'm glad I thought about it. It was Haig right. Brown.
Oh, Haig Brown. Yeah.
But some of the stories that I've heard from people about how the things they've seen out angling. And so I think for a lot of us too, it's as much about that connection to family and friends, right? Dan Wank, who was the superintendent of Yellowstone, told me a story about what fishing means to him. And what really struck home, or what really got me about it, was he talked about it's so much less about the fishing for him now. It's about being out there, but it's also about connecting to those times that his grandfather or father or brothers or people who are no longer around went out with us, you know, having those memories and kind of refreshing that in our minds about those special moments that we shared with the people we loved in these places that we love. And somehow that being there makes that memory stronger. I think Norman McLean wrote at the end of A River Runs Through It about the water rushing over the rocks and the words under the rocks, and that some of the words were theirs. And, you know, I think he was really talking about that connection that we all have to family, to those that we love in these places that we love.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. I always, The River Runs Through It has such a, Norman McLean, did you ever talk to him?
So I didn't talk to Norman. I did talk to his son and was able to interview his son. And I have been able to, one of my claims to fames, if I have any, is that I was able to visit the cabin on Sealy Lake, and I was able to sit there and read part of A River Runs Through It while I was there, which was I mean, I'm surrounded by pictures of Norman and his brother and his parents, and knowing that, you know, they had all sorts of fishing adventures in this spot where I was sitting was a really cool thing.
Oh, wow. That is cool. So why, Uganda, what took you to Uganda?
So I had actually presented at a conference over there, and then I bounced around a little bit and did some interviews. So I've done quite a few interviews in Africa and throughout Asia, Africa. So wherever the British went, there's trout.
Right. And I was going to say, yeah, Uganda has actually trout.
Yeah. Yeah. There's
so these trout. Aren't native. So you're not documenting where the native distribution of trout.
It's No. I mean, I certainly have done that in a lot of places. Done some interviews in Mexico, Canada, across Europe, you know, really focusing on native fish. And native fish or trout are really special to me. But of course, some of our best angling and some of our most famous angling is in the Southern Hemisphere, where there are no native species or trout or salmonids. And so, you know, I've documented a lot of that as well. But South Africa, they love their trout fishing. There are trout in some of the national parks in Ethiopia, Zimbabwe, Zambia, and some... The interviews I did there, I think I did about a dozen interviews when I was there. And that was where I caught malaria. So those were some of the hardest interviews I've ever done, but it was pretty cool. It was great hearing their stories. It was great hearing their stories about, kind of how things have changed over time from, you know, like from when it used to be Rhodesia. And I always really enjoy hearing people's stories and hearing about kind of the story of them. What I always tell people for archives is that, yeah, we're interested in, you know, the reason why we're probably talking and why we're interested in your papers is your connection to angling or fishing or what have you. But an archival collection really tells the story of a person. It's about them. We want somebody to be able to look at these papers in 50 or 100 or 200 years, or as long as there's an MSU for that matter, that will help tell the story of who that person was, and unfiltered, you know, the good, the bad, et cetera. And in some ways, these interviews, when we talk about asking people about what fishing means to them or how they got started or what they love about it, it tells a little story about them. And I think preserving that, we're doing something important. And I think that the idea of preserving these for future generations, I've had multiple on several different occasions, I've had people reach out to me that their father or their mother or their uncle has since passed, and they wanted a copy of this interview, or they wanted to link back to it from the obituary, or they wanted to show a part of it at the wake, because this was the only film that they had of them actually kind of talking and smiling and being relaxed. And I've always really been touched by that.
That's really cool. I think that I kind of look at the same thing like what we're doing, right? I mean, I just enjoy the interviews, you know. It's just like this one is just like the other, you know, whatever we've done, 400 we've done. It's just fun to hear the story, and your story is, you know, they're all good, whether you're like Lefty Cray or if you're just getting started fly fishing, right? It's always because it's a human story, I think. Is that what it is for you? I guess you just said it, right? But that's it. It's the person.
No, I absolutely agree. It is the human story. And I mean, some of them are, you know, even the first stories. I interviewed a young gentleman a few years back who, I had to get his parents' permission to interview him. I think he was 14 or 15, but he told me a story about the first trout he ever caught was on a fly he tied and a rod he built. How cool is that? You know, that was cool. I mean, those are some cute, cool little human stories that I think get mixed in there. And sometimes you don't, and sometimes our best stories are the ones, I'm guessing you've seen this too, that you don't expect to find.
Bearvault is one way to assure your next backcountry trip stays memorable, epic, and safe. Bearvault builds a rugged polycarbonate locking canister that keeps bears and other wild animals away from your food. This in turn keeps your food safe, keeps the bears safe, and keeps you safe. I've got a classic story that I've told a few times about the bear taking my backpack while up in Alaska. I had my lunch and some snacks in there and just went up around the corner to fish for a bit. And when I got back, it was totally gone. If I would have had that bear vault right at that moment, I would have been okay because my food would have been completely sealed. The bear would have had no idea and no reason to take my backpack. So a good reminder there. You might not realize it, but this type of thing happens all the time, even to experienced outdoorsmen. The great news for us is now we can experience the great stuff of a remote trip without ever having to worry about animals fiddling with our stuff. Sleep soundly knowing your vault has sealed the deal for you. Believe it or not, food storage is a key consideration while backcountry hiking, fishing, or camping. The Bear Vault also has some great bonus features like the see-through sidewall so you can find your stuff really easy, and a large opening, plus it doubles as a nice camp stool. This thing is legit. It definitely is one of my, this might be my favorite feature is the camp stool. You know, I love a good chair out there. Check in with the crew at Bear Vault at wetflyswing.com/bearvault. That's Bear Vault, BEARVAULT. Okay, back to the show. Right on. Well, I was just, you know, going back, I was just trying to make sure we capture your story, you know, again, because you talked about it. You were kind of out in Wisconsin. And remind us again, so how did you get out to Bozeman?
I grew up in Wisconsin. I got my graduate degrees in Wisconsin. I had applied for a job at Montana State, at MSU Bozeman, Montana State University Bozeman, as a reference librarian. And they flew me out, offered me the gig, and that's how I came out to Bozeman. I passed through there once in college. A buddy of mine and I took a road trip out to Olympic National Park. And just us and our dogs, my old dog Buster and his dog Tigger, both of whom are passed now. But and we stopped in Bozeman. I remember thinking, wow, this is a cool place. This would be a cool place to live. And when I saw the job come up, I applied, and I was lucky enough to get it. And that's what brought me out to Montana. And that's largely what's kept me out there. It's a beautiful state, great fishing. We get 300 days of sunshine a year. I live about it's become more expensive, but I live about an hour outside of campus in an off-grid home that I built myself. So, Montana has a lot of good adventures to offer. And, I've met some incredible people out there, and, made some good friends and caught some really good fish.
That's really cool. I gotta hear about this off-grid home. This sounds pretty amazing. Was that something where you just have the skills of, or did you just start something, kind of read some blogs and go for it?
So that's exactly what I did, was I just kind of, I read up on it a little bit. I mean, my old stepdad had, when I was a kid, Earl had taught me how to use some power tools and things like that. And my uncle had a farm and worked a little bit on that, but never really did much carpentry. But I made a decision that it was something that I wanted to do. And my theory was always, if I couldn't think of a reason why it wouldn't work, I'd give it a shot. And that didn't always play out. But for the most part, it did. Built my first home there by scratch, using a lot of recycled material. So I did a lot of dumpster diving and things like that for salvage and wood. I remember my first shower was, I found a bunch of old street signs behind one of the dorms one day that I'm sure were up in a student's room or what have you. But I used those to line my first shower. I figured, oh, well, they're waterproof. They will work. So, and they did.
Wow.
But... But learn the difference between solar and wind, and especially in Montana, we don't most of our water we get in the spring, so you got to be careful with that if you're not digging a well. And I did all rain catchment for my water, but
wow. So no well, it's all
no
all
well. Rain. Yeah, so I'd recycle the water from my sinks in my shower, and that's what I'd use for the toilet. So I'd use the gray water for the toilet, and that would be what went to the septic. But all rain catchment is just about the idea of the old saying, making hay while the sun shines. It's just about being able to collect enough water while it rains to be able to get you through. The one tip I'd have for anybody in Montana who's looking to go off grid is the sun shines 300 days a year. Panels are a better bet than a windmill, at least in Montana. Oh,
yeah. And are panels getting, panels have been out there for a while now, but is the tech there now that it's just even better? Is it getting better and better?
It's getting better and better, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper, which is really nice. I think when the first panels I bought, I want to say I paid about $3 or $4 a watt. Now I can get it for about 50 cents a watt. And so it's come way down in price. If anybody's thinking about going off grid, the other advice I'd have is always go with more panels and more batteries than you think you'll need.
Right. Gosh, that's amazing. So everything is out there. And how many square feet are you powering, or are you living in there?
About 1,100 square feet. And it's for the most part, it's just like living on grid. There's not a whole lot of difference. You try to stay away from things like, so I have a shaved head.
Microwaves.
So yeah. Microwaves, hair dryers. I was going to say my shaved head, I don't need one, but, things that draw a lot of resistive heat. Obviously you have a gas stove, not an electric stove. I've got a 50-inch TV. I've got a big double-door French freezer, fridge. It's just about being conscious and doing the little things. All the lights should be LED, and you save power where you can. On-demand hot water heater, so you're not using, you're only using that power when you're actually using hot water.
But right. And are there people around you that are on the grid?
No, I'm about 5 miles or so from the grid. So all my neighbors are off grid, and it's a real welcoming community. And so they were really able to help me kind of get in the idea of what to do. When I built the greenhouse, one of my neighbors was, he had worked on aquaponics in its initial phases, and he gave me some great tips, as did my uncle, who has a farm on greenhouses. They said, build them high. You want the heat to have a place to go. And I never really thought about that, but, it's all about that tempered zone where the plants live. So little tips like that have been great. But for the most part, it's like, with today's technology, with Starlink and other internet services,
yeah, and what's his name, Elon Musk and all that stuff.
Yeah. So you can get internet pretty much anywhere you are, which is nice.
That's so cool. It reminds me, in Montana again, you hear so much about it. It's always the fly fishing, one of the top places you hear about. But you also hear about, like, is it Bo's Angeles? Is that kind of one of the names you hear?
That is, I've seen it grown remarkably in the last.
But you still have, it sounds like you still have these places, like there's still plenty of lots of wild space. It's not right. It's not,
oh yeah. Like, no, yeah, no, we've still got lots of, we've still got lots of space in Montana. We've still got, I think we're the second or third largest state, and, we're 48 or somewhere in there in terms of population. One of our old senators, I'm not a huge fan of him, but he did have a great quote that was, something like, there's a lot of dirt between light bulbs in Montana.
Yeah, it's still not, there's not a lot of people. Yeah, it's a similar, it's probably, I'm not sure if you've been up to Alaska or whatever, but I'm sure there's a similar type of person that, wants to live, right? Like you're living off the grid. I mean, it takes a certain person to be able to live off the grid.
It is one of those things where you just have to, once you accept it, it's all right. But you have that idea where every problem is your problem. When my mom would come out to visit, she sometimes couldn't understand why nobody would come to plow the road or things like that. And it's, you have to go back to, you have to be a self-starter. You have to be kind of willing to, okay, my light's not turning around. Okay, what could it be? And you trace that back. But I'm a believer that anybody who wanted to could do this. And part of it is even taking those small steps, like, the on-demand hot water heaters and things like that can make a huge difference. But
yeah. Perfect. Good. Well, that takes us back a little bit of your story. So basically, I mean, you got there, you got to MSU, and I mean, that the rest is history, right? You met Bud Lilly and fly fishing. I mean, when you look ahead now at what you have going, you know, what does that look like? Do you see some new things coming up or just more interviews? It looks like you do about, out of 360, you've done, you know, like roughly 36 per year, just roughly averaging it out. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, you know, almost one a week, not quite. But yeah, are you going to keep on the same track and just producing content?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we're going to keep on this. We're going to grow the collection, actively seeking those kind of underrepresented voices like we talked about earlier in the hour, you know, women, other folks that maybe aren't as represented. And then, of course, you know, the rock stars. If I get a chance to interview Michael Keaton or Oprah or somebody else who fishes, I certainly will.
But you will. Right. Yeah, yeah. One of our claims to fame is I love to throw this one out because it was such a fun episode. But Henry Winkler.
Oh, very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. He's down. Actually, he fishes down south, I think, in Idaho. He does that every year.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting interview. And that was one that was probably one of my most, you know, anxious interviews, right? Because it's the Fonz.
Yeah.
And you don't want to screw it up. But it was really cool. Yeah. We talked about fishing and he talked about what fly fishing meant to him, right? And then we got into a little bit of his new show, you know, Barry, which he won an Emmy, sure, which is kind of a crazy show.
No, that's great. I've heard he's a really cool guy. He's got a book, I think it's called I've Never Met an Idiot on the River or something.
That's
like
right.
That.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, we talked about that. And he's just a super cool guy. Yeah, and there's a few of those big names you mentioned, you know, Eric Clapton's out there. There's definitely some people. Fly fishing is I don't know what it is. It's just not everybody does it. But once you do it, it seems like most people get addicted to it. Do you kind of feel that way?
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of, I'll just throw one out there too of cool celebrities that I've met. Jeremy Wade, the River Monsters guy.
Oh, yeah. Right, right.
So yeah. I got to go fishing with Jeremy. I know him a little bit. He was our lecturer. We also do an annual lecture series at the university. So we've had... Nat Reed was a speaker one year with Jeremy. But anyway, Jeremy was one of the most down-to-earth, coolest people I've ever met in terms of... I hosted him when he was in Bozeman. You know, we'd go out to lunch, we'd go out and hang out. And everywhere we went, people were coming up to him. Hey, can I get an autograph? Hey, can I get a picture? As gracious of a guy as could be with that.
Yeah, Jeremy. And what did you guys go fishing for some river monsters?
I mean, we went fishing for some browns. I don't know that you'd call them river monsters, but during his talk, he did show a picture of a little caddisfly versus one of the hooks he normally uses when he's like on the Amazon or something.
And yeah,
it was a pretty big disparity. But he's a well-educated guy. He's written quite a bit on fishing as well. And one of the things that he did in his talk, which I was a little surprised by, but he opened it by apologizing. He said, I know my show makes it look like you can still go to all these kind of back corners of the world and just land these big, huge fish. And he said, it's harder and harder. He said, you know, climate change, pollution, things we're doing as humans are affecting fishing on a global scale. And that's something we should all be concerned about. But it was... a cool little message to give to the student. He spoke to a lot of our students. So
nice, nice, good. Well, and I just had one more note here. I was going to check with you. So yeah, I mean, I'm obviously with the podcasting. It's just a type, and probably my guess is 5, 10 years, 20 years from now, there'll be something else, right? It might not be called podcast anymore, but it is the oral, right? Is the long form interview? Do you find, I mean, where else can you find these long form interviews like this? I mean, not just fly fishing, but it seems like those are going away. Do you feel that's the same?
I think in some respects they are. I think part of it is kind of the change in media, right? We're much more about, as a society in some respects, I think we're more about the soundbite than kind of the deep dive, so to speak, I guess. But yeah, they're certainly still out there. There are a lot of archives like ours and many others, AMFF, a lot of organizations that are looking to preserve this knowledge for future generations. That's what archives do, really, is the idea of that we want to create a snapshot of not only our time, but you know, times before us, and preserve that, keep that around for future generations. So, our plan is to keep doing that as long as there's a Montana State University out there to do it at.
And can people download when they go to listen? I mean, they can get copies of like periodicals, right? You send mm-hmm. them books or whatever. Can people actually download the videos or the, you know, the interviews?
I believe you can. And certainly we can arrange for that to happen if somebody's interviewed in the interviews or if somebody's interested in the interviews. This is something that we will be happy to share these with anybody who's interested.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's really awesome. I mean, basically essentially a free resource, right? That's your idea. I mean, what is the mission? What is the, like, what is when you come down, you know, at the essence of what you do for, maybe explain that just briefly.
Sure. I can sum it up pretty quickly. It's really about preserving the global history and culture of angling. And that's what we want to do through these interviews is preserve these stories, preserve these knowledge. Worst case is a snapshot of what was, but you know, otherwise just really kind of to share that rich history of angling and to keep it out there for future generations.
Perfect. And you want to give a quick heads up on, you know, now we're kind of March going into April here pretty soon, what you have coming in the next kind of the rest of this year, anything new or you want to give a shout out to?
Yeah. So we always do our lecture series. That'll be coming up in the fall. Our last one was with Jim Getz, who was really instrumental in getting us fishing access and preserving our fishing access in the state of Montana. That's something we're always working on. This fall, I'm going to be teaching a class at the university on using archives, on angling, and the history of it. And part of that will accumulate with a we're going to go down to Belize for about 10 days go check out some of the fishing down there. Hopefully get a line in the water, maybe for some permit, tarpon, or bonefish.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Sounds like a pretty good gig. So good. Yeah, okay. We'll send everybody out to, like we said earlier, I guess just like you said, search Angling Oral History Project, Montana State University.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, feel free to, link back to my email. If anybody has direct questions for me, feel free to reach out anytime. I'll be happy to help with any of the information we have. And if you just want a tip on where's good to get a line in the water around Bozeman, I'm happy to help with that as well.
Okay. And you, you go by Jim or James or both?
6-1. Yeah. Yeah. I go by both. So
perfect. All right. All right. Well, we called you James at the start, so we'll leave it off with James. James Thule. I appreciate you coming on today and shedding some light on what you have going. It's an amazing body of work. You know, I remember we interviewed John Gehrig as well, and I remember asking him some of that. You know, some of that stuff. Like, what is it? You know, the whole thing, right? What does it mean to him? And it was really interesting. I think it is about the body of work, right? It's not about any one interview or anything you do. Do you feel that for you? That's what it is. You look back at this whole thing you've created because it really has been you, right?
I mean, I've had a lot of support, but Bud and I definitely kind of came up with the idea to do it. So I've certainly played a part, I would say, but it's been great. And I agree. It is about the larger body of work. And I think a lot like you do with your 400 plus interviews and documenting that. And I think you mentioned John. I think you've interviewed Bruce Staples, a few other folks. My guess is our wires have crossed more than once already. But
that's right.
But I think it's really important what you're doing as well and getting that stuff out there and preserving that and allow people to learn more about angling and also be able to kind of preserve that knowledge for folks. So well done.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, James. All right. We'll keep in touch with you and we will talk to you soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much.
There we go. Wetflyswing.com/452. 452. Check it out right now. You can get the show notes, find out, get some links over to see some of those amazing guests. I'm sure we'll have a link to the Lefty Cray interview there and whatever else we can add to it. Check it out right now. Quick reminder before we get out of here, you can join the live event tonight on Facebook where we're going to announce the Skeena's Bay Lodge winner and the big prize pack, see who won this massive this trip and the products. And we're likely going to be giving away some bonus products as well tonight. So check it out right now for a chance to win some bonus. And this isn't just hats and stickers. We got some good stuff we're giving away tonight. Check it out. Wetflyswing.com/live. Quick listeners shout out before we hop out here as well tonight. Rick Wagner. All right. I got a quick one from Rick Wagner. He checked in. Rick has been a listener for a while here. And he checked in and said, Dave, loved your interview with the great John Gearock. There we go. I love it. Short and sweet and to the point, John Gearock. That was one of my favorites. I'm going to hopefully get John on in a future episode if we can moving forward. So thanks, Rick, for checking in here and for giving us some love there, and I appreciate that. If you want to get a shout-out, you can check in with me, Dave, at wetflyswing.com anytime or on social media, and just let me know. Email is easy. You could do that, and I'll give you a shout-out, and I'll put together an episode for you as well. All right, let's take a quick look tonight at the live event. We are going to be turning around tomorrow, and we're jumping right back into it. We are heading in with the traveled program, and then we're jumping in on the next episode to wrap it up this week. So stay tuned. It's a big week, and I hope you can connect with me, maybe online or on the water, if you're a winner of this trip, or if you just want to straight up and pick up a slot. We're going to have a limited number of spots to pay and head over to the Skeenest Bay Lodge. And I think we have the early bird special going on right now. You can check that out, wetflyswing.com/school. That's school, S-C-H-O-O-L, school. Check it out and find out if you want to grab a slot. Check it out. Just enter your email name and we'll follow up with you and let you know if we have any availability still. This is the time. It's going to be going quick for this one. All right. I hope you're having a good evening, good morning, or good afternoon, wherever you are in the world. And I appreciate you for stopping in today. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.